The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, this is Annie.
And Samantha.
And welcome to Stuff Mom Never Told You, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. As I said a past episode ago, time. Very, very confused by time right now. I am probably in Disney World.
Again.
As this drops, yes. Which I unfortunately did not realize that we would be going for work.
Right.
Like barely 2 months ago. And also that the ride, the new Star Wars ride, will not be open, which is one of the whole reasons I wanted to go.
You should be like run in protest with a protest sign.
You think I should run with it? So I'm running a race.
Right.
Well, and that's part of the problem is that you have to sign up for those races
right
way in advance.
And you don't know.
Right. And I think it was supposed to be open, but it's not. I mean, I'm going to Disney. It's going to be fun. But there's a part of me that's just going to be thinking, oh, the ride, the cool ride that will be open like less than a month from now. But because that is on my mind right now, we wanted to talk about this classic episode that Kristen and Caroline did around the women behind Disney.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Which is something when I was a kid, I actually really wanted to do special effects specifically, but also animation.
Right.
And then I discovered that my drawing capabilities, well, they were lacking.
I can't draw.
Yeah.
I used to be able to draw penguins, and then people were like, what's that? And I'm like, okay, I can't draw penguins, apparently.
Well, I've told the story on air how I carved that. I was supposed to be a horse, but my art teacher thought it was a polar bear. And so I was like, yes.
Yeah, obviously.
It was definitely a polar bear. And that's not to say, you know, hard work can get you certainly further than
right.
That level of talent that I displayed or that you displayed. And also, what we're going to talk about, or what this classic episode is going to look about, is other aspects of animating, because it's more than just drawing,
right?
And Disney's army of animation girls. So, we hope you enjoy this classic episode.
Welcome to Stuff Mom Never Told You from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Kristen.
And I'm Caroline.
And we're talking about women animators at Disney today. And the idea happened very much by accident one evening on Twitter when I had posted on StuffMomNeverToldYou.tumblr.com, our Tumblr account, this 1938 rejection letter that has been spread around the internet. A lot of you listening have probably seen it, but it's this form letter that Disney sent out to women who applied to be animators, basically saying, and we'll read it verbatim in just a minute, but it basically says, sorry, women don't do really any of the creative work, so good luck.
Yeah, it was harsh. Like, if I'd received that letter, I would have been so disheartened.
But soon after, I posted it on Tumblr, got a tweet from a woman who wrote her master's on animation history, and she pointed out that while, yes, this is clearly a form letter that Disney actually sent out, there's a lot of misconceptions about women's roles at classic Disney. Mm-hmm. Talking about back in the day of Bambi, Dumbo, Sleeping Beauty, Snow White. And she said that that was pretty much standard at animation studios in the 1930s period. And so I decided, hey, you know what? This sounds like a pretty good podcast topic.
It's a great podcast topic. I was definitely interested in reading all about how these women who were in the industry and the roles they play. I mean, these women worked so hard. The women who were actually hired by Disney, who loved the idea of working for Disney. People, both men and women who worked under him, were just enamored of the idea of even working at Disney, or Disney's, as they called it, like it was a department store.
Yeah. And it's actually good timing that we're talking about this, because not too long ago, Meryl Streep raised a lot of Hollywood eyebrows when she was giving this sort of honorary speech for Emma Thompson in her work in Saving Mr. Banks, the recent film about Mary Poppins and Walt Disney. And, you know, Disney kind of made it in a way to personify Walt Disney. But in the speech that Meryl Streep is giving at the National Board of Review Awards ceremony, she calls Walt Disney a gender bigot and a lot of other things that aren't too kind. And the evidence that she uses, though, to back up this claim is a quote from Disney animator Ward Kimball, who allegedly said that Walt Disney, quote, didn't trust women or cats.
Right. And she also cited that 1938 rejection letter as her reasoning. But yeah, Disney's attitude, a lot of people on the internet, both scholarly and not, argue about Disney's attitude towards women. You know, was he this gender bigot, as Meryl Streep says? Was he just a product of his times? You know, was he just afraid of losing his workforce to marriage and babies? There's a whole lot of back and forth about it.
So we also just wanted to take a minute, though, to shine a light on all of these women animators who rarely get any credit for these classic Disney films that were probably a part of a lot of our childhoods. So let's start off with that 1938 Disney rejection letter. What exactly did it say?
So basically, this form letter was telling the woman who had applied that, okay, so you can't be a major animator. Girls are not considered for the training school. And then it went on to explain that the work that was open to women specifically consisted of tracing the characters on clear celluloid sheets with India ink and filling in the tracings on the reverse side with paint according to directions. So how hard could that be, right? But when we were reading this Vanity Fair article about women at Disney in the early days, I mean, these are women who worked hours and hours and hours doing a lot of the what was called in-betweener work. So a lot of the movement, a lot of the in-between things between all the big action, showing what Goofy was doing or showing what Bambi was doing.
And like that Twitter follower pointed out, this was standard policy at animation studios at the time, which is a little bit nuts when you consider that in the history of animation, it is actually a woman named Lottie Reiniger who's credited with directing one of the first feature-length animated films in 1926, and it's called The Adventures of Prince Ahmed. And her animation is incredible. I mean, she actually uses, rather than drawing everything out as we would think of in a Disney film, she actually cut out silhouettes that she would move around on screen. And it was insane what she was doing. And yet, in the 1930s, women just No, you stick to tracing and right. That's it.
Right. Yeah, it is interesting to look at that 1926 blip on the overall timeline of animation because, okay, well, so obviously women are involved in this from the get-go and they're interested in it and they can do it and they can do an awesome job at it. But we need to give you some context. So let's do a brief rundown of like a Disney timeline. So the Walt Disney Company itself was started by brothers Walt and Roy in 1923 out in Los Angeles. 2 years later, Disney opens their famous Hyperion Avenue studio location. And back then it was all dudes, as photos from the time attest. And 2 years after that, in 1927, we have the first of, as Kristen pointed out, the Nine Old Men, which were basically Disney's main animators. Les Clark hired on as an in-betweener. And as we said, that's the people who draw all the stuff that appears between the normal action that is drawn by a lead animator. And in 1928, the mascot of all mascots, Mickey Mouse, is born.
So fast forward to 1937, and you have the release of Disney's first full-length animated feature, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. And all of the supervising animation is being done by those nine old men. And usually when you hear about classic Disney and you hear about the animations, a lot of times, up until recently at least, it's been the nine old men who, I mean, deservedly so, get a lot of credit for it. And side note, the reason why they were called the nine old men, that was Walt Disney's joking nickname reference to them, riffing on how the Supreme Court at the time was referred to, I think by like FDR or something, as the nine old men. Because, hey, guess what? It's 1930s, and of course, there were no women in the Supreme Court. So behind, though, that production of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, you have this almost army of these women who were referred to as Walt's girls, who mm-hmm. were doing all of that in-betweener work, all of the tracing, all of the inking, a lot of the coloring and painting, essentially taking these incredible drawings that the Nine Old Men would have been making and really bringing them to life on those celluloids for the screen.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting the description of why and how all these women were recruited. I think it's interesting how it kind of compares to World War II when we hear about women having to enter the workforce because there were so many gaps left by men. I mean, obviously it's not the same thing, but Walt Disney needed such a big workforce to animate these cutting edge, new, never before seen types of films that he was like, we've got to get some labor in here. And so he did. He began recruiting these animation girls, many of whom had not gone to college, but they were trained in sort of animation classes. They sort of got, you know, trial by fire when they were hired. And when you look at the Disney animation system sort of at large, talking about training, it was sort of almost like an apprentice master setup going on. But for the women, where they would get kind of thrown in like, hey, you look like you're young and healthy and can handle long hours. Come on board and learn how to ink and paint and watercolor. They might have gotten classes, but they wouldn't have gotten the same types of classes that the men got.
And the reason why they were immediately funneled into ink and paint was because the inking training was sort of the base level that took mm-hmm. half the time of animation training. And in that Vanity Fair oral history of the women working on Snow White in particular, some said that, I mean, they would have to bring in some examples of their artwork, but some of them said that they were hired simply because they looked healthy, because Walt knew that it was going to be such a grueling process that they were going to need to be able to work insane hours. Because when you think about it, this animation process back then was so time consuming. So for instance, one girl could do 8 to 10 cells per hour. That means that 100 of these employees could produce about 1 minute of film every day. That's how tedious this whole inking and painting process was.
Yeah, and so at the height of Snow White production, because you have to think, I mean, the context of this is that Snow White was the first thing of its kind, the first animated feature that was more than an hour and that involved all sorts of techniques that they were almost developing on the fly. How do we give her a better blush to her cheeks? Developing different techniques like that. And so these people, both men and women, were working 85-hour work weeks. There was one woman who was describing her life during that time, and she would go home after a long day, walk into the closet to take her clothes off, and it would suddenly occur to her, am I coming or going? Yeah. Am I getting dressed for work or am I coming home from work? Sometimes they would just take pillows to work, not only to soften the hard wooden chair they were sitting in, but so that they could take naps.
Yeah, and just to give you a sense of what exactly they were doing, a Disney employment brochure at the time said, all inking and painting of celluloids and all tracing done in the studio is performed exclusively by a large staff of girls known as the inkers and painters. This work, exacting in character, calls for great skill in the handling of pen and brush. And again, it goes on to state, this is the only department in the Disney studio open to women artists.
Right. And one, and again, another woman who was interviewed in that Vanity Fair piece was talking about how I did not smoke or drink or bowl during this time because you couldn't have your hands shake, but you also couldn't have your lovely Angora wool sweater drifting like pieces of fuzz anywhere. And so the women started having to wear aprons, and so they didn't get finger smudges on anything. They had to wear these white, these thin white gloves and just cut off the fingertips of their drawing hand. So as reports go from the time, if you were to just wander into the inking and painting section, you would be like, wow, look at all these high class dames working with their pen and ink.
And it's because though there were so many very young, usually well-dressed, attractive women in the ink and paint department that it became known as the nunnery. Because down the line, after the release of Snow White and when Disney opened its new, bigger and grander studios, Walt kind of drew a line basically saying, hey, all you male animators, you need to stay out of the nunnery. There's too much canoodling going on. Because these women would also talk about how in the brief breaks that they would get from these 85-hour work weeks of inking and painting and tracing, etc., they would all go out onto the front lawn and they would sometimes meet up secretly with their animator beaus underneath trees. And they, I don't know if they'd smooch or not. That sounds scandalous for the time.
Yeah, one guy described it as being like high school, where you would go out, and there were a lot of marriages that came out of the Disney Animation Department, to the point where a competitor in their like materials to try to attract employees even said that, like, you know, Disney over there with all their office romances, they're not getting enough work done because they were so famous for having all of these people get married, which makes sense when you're spending so many freaking intense hours with people.
Well, then there's a question, too, of whether or not Walt Disney took advantage of the fact that he had dozens upon dozens of very young women working for him. And there are some rumors that, yeah, absolutely, there would have been some canoodling. I keep saying canoodling on Walt Disney's couch. But there were other women who reported back, no, we always thought of him as Uncle Walt. He was very professional. We never would have crossed that line.
Well, he married an animator. I mean, he married one of the girls, quote unquote, from the early days, back when like everybody, it was like Cheers, everybody knew your name.
Yeah. And Walt Disney, though, definitely has his controversies involving his thoughts on race, gender, etc. There are some quotes that are typically trotted out in defense of his position on women. So, you know, we have to mention this. In 1941, he said, if a woman can do the work well, she's worth as much as a man. The girl artists have the right to expect the same chances for advancement as men. And I honestly believe they may eventually, contribute something to this business that men never could or would. And this he was apparently saying to the male artists working on Dumbo.
And many years later, in 1959, Walt was quoted as saying that women are the best judges of anything we turn out. Their taste is very important. They are the theater goers. They are the ones who drag the men in. If the women like it, to heck with the men. Which sounds like, you know, advertising strategy, baseline advertising strategy today, where people are like, if you target the women who are in control of the pocketbooks at home, then the men will follow.
Exactly. And those two quotes are, you know, a couple of reasons why when Meryl Streep made the comment about him being a gender bigot, they took offense, saying, well, no, he actually was on record as saying that, you know, women could be anything that they wanted to be in Disney. But breaking through the celluloid ceiling was no joke. I mean, you can say that it's a product of its time, but nevertheless, it's still kind of on the mark that there was a specific role that they were allowed to do, and it was kind of limited to that point. But it seems like once he saw the work that these women were doing and he spotted some of the talent among them, there were a few, emphasis on a few, opportunities for advancement, particularly when World War II happens, because just like in pretty much all other realms of employment in the U.S., a bunch of men leave and that opens up jobs for women. And so in 1941, in fact, the ink and paint department employees were invited to submit Donald Duck drawings for an animation department consideration. And out of that, three women were chosen to be trained as in-betweeners and background artists during World War II. And there were a number of other women, too, who had been working, for instance, on Snow White, who were put on government-funded Disney jobs. There was a lot of Disney pro-U.S. propaganda that was coming out at the time. And so there were these kind of top-secret animation missions that some of the women interviewed in Vanity Fair were involved with, but a lot of it was very shrouded in secrecy, and half the time they didn't really know what they were working on anyway.
Yeah, it turned out to be Donald Duck making fun of Hitler.
Yeah.
Everybody plays a part, I guess. So before we introduce you to some of these celluloid-shattering ladies who worked at Disney, let's take a quick break.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly boring since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
And so when we left off, we had kind of laid the groundwork for what it was like for women working at Disney in the 1930s and early 1940s. And essentially, you were relegated to the ink and paint department. But there were some notable names who broke through that celluloid ceiling.
Yeah, so we have Bianca Majoli, who was Walt Disney's story department's first female employee. She came up with the idea for Elmer Elephant, which was sort of the precursor to Dumbo. That was back in 1936. And it's sort of credited as, I mean, Walt Disney was totally enamored with the idea, talking about how her story, all the humor of her story was really grounded in this heartwarming, kind of almost serious story. And that's what made the humor not seem brittle or fragile, but actually heartwarming, really.
Yeah, yeah. And in addition to the ink and paint department, the story department was another one where, even though it didn't say so in that Disney brochure, there were more opportunities for women to jump on board, because Walt was surprised kind of at Bianca's idea to humanize this elephant. Mm-hmm. It was like an angle of storytelling that seemed particularly female to him, like, oh, well, of course a woman will go in and you know, and make something very, very tender and kind. And so that's a nice element to add to these stories that we're trying to tell. But then there's also Sylvia Moberly Holland, who first was working as a sketch artist at Universal and then joined on at Disney in 1938. And she eventually led the story team for the Waltz of the Flowers in Fantasia. And that was something that was interesting for me to learn that I didn't realize about the animation process, is that a lot of, unlike a film with people in it where you have this actress playing the role of this throughout the film, when it comes to animation, the animators are credited with, you know, maybe specific characters, but also just sequences in the film. It's not like you have one person doing one major thing throughout the entire movie. So it might not sound like a big deal that Moberly Holland just led the story team for this Waltz of the Flowers, but that was very significant. I mean, Fantasia was a massive undertaking for them as well.
Absolutely. I mean, it is pretty intense. I mean, Fantasia might have scared me as a kid.
Yeah.
Parts of it.
I did not get Fantasia as a child.
I was like, this is, if I had known what trippy meant, I was thinking, this is really trippy.
Yeah.
Like, mommy, it's a bad dream. Okay, well, then you have Retta Scott, who I think I like her pluck, I guess, because she was assumed to be, she's very tiny, a tiny person, blonde, curly hair, freckles, very happy, with a glint in her eye, people said. She was the one who was responsible for the scary, vicious hunting dogs in Bambi. And when some of the dude animators saw these dogs, they were like, ah, there's no way a chick did this. Like, I'm sure it was some burly man over in the animation department. Nope, it was smiley little Retta.
Yeah, and it was those hunting dogs that got their attention and eventually got her the promotion into animation, because she was first hired on with Disney again in the story department in 1938. But in Bambi, she became Disney's first credited female animator on a feature film. And so whenever you hear about women at Disney, the history of women in animation at Disney, Retta Scott comes up over and over again. I mean, she is the one that you hear really breaking through that celluloid ceiling, because she was up there with, I mean, alongside those nine old men animating, not just doing the in-between work, not just doing the inking and painting.
Mm-hmm. So we also have Mary Blair, who, along with her husband Lee, worked at Disney. She started in 1940 and did some art for Dumbo, and then moved on to serving as art supervisor and color stylist for the film Saludos Amigos, The Three Caballeros, Cinderella, Alice in Wonderland, and Peter Pan.
Yeah, I mean, Mary Blair, probably of all the women of this time, and I mean, and even up to contemporary Disney, has been one of, if not the most influential, because it was really her art aesthetic that put Disney, like, gave Disney animation a little bit more of a modernist flair. And through September 2014, the Walt Disney Museum is honoring her with an exhibit called Magic Color Flair, The World of Mary Blair. And the museum explains that, quote, of all his artists, this female artist was Walt's favorite, and he allowed her to have as significant an impact on post-war Disney style as Albert Herter had in the 1930s. And they go on to talk about how her concept paintings inspired and influenced the look and style of all of the South American films. She had actually traveled to South America with Walt as part of sort of a propaganda mission via FDR's good neighbor policy. So it was sort of like visual sourcing to go down there. And so that influenced the movies like Saludos Amigos and The Three Caballeros. But it was also her aesthetic that she brought into Cinderella, Alice in Wonderland, and Peter Pan. I mean, think about those movies, how distinctive they look. And that is Mary Blair.
And isn't she the one who Walt made the comment about, Mary knows colors that I've never even thought of.
Yeah.
Like she has a different eye from the rest of us. And it was that same aesthetic that ended up influencing, say what you will about this, but It's a Small World for the 1964-65 New York's World Fair. I'm sorry, I know the song is in everyone's head now.
But when you think about Disney attractions, even though, yes, that song is, oh God, yeah, and it is now in my head. But as an attraction, it's almost timeless. Like, we still associate it so much mm-hmm. with Disney. Although, I don't know, maybe it's all Pirates of the Caribbean now.
Yeah, I would have no idea. I don't like crowds, and I don't like sticky things. And I feel like everything at theme parks is sticky.
Yeah.
Too much juice and cotton candy. But, okay, so we are talking a lot about Disney, and I think we can move forward now into the modern-day animation landscape, because I feel like it's getting better, even though there still is a huge gender gap and kind of a gap in a perception about what women can do.
Yeah, one of the most challenging aspects of this podcast topic was that finding sources on women in animation were surprisingly sparse, even though if you look at CalArts, which is the premier animation school in the U.S., like if you want to be an animator, you go to CalArts, and the animation students are, you know, it's 50% women, 50% men. And yet, if you look at the Animation Guild, only 17% of its members are female. But that might have something to do with women, at least according to Linda Simensky, who was Cartoon Network's VP of Original Animation. According to her, women are likelier to pursue independent rather than big studio animation.
Yeah, and I mean, part of that, if I had to guess, would have to do with the fact that a lot of women traditionally haven't been in the higher ranks of animation studios from the get-go, as we've seen. And so when you have a setup like that in any industry, I feel like people who are generally marginalized are more likely to go sort of that independent, kooky, creative route.
Yeah, and before I forget, I just want to mention that I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts recently, Professor Blastoff, and they were interviewing animator Sarah Pocock, who, if you are a fan of Cosmos, hosted by Neil deGrasse Tyson, she does all of the animation for that. Hmm. And I thought of her when I was looking at the animation from the episode of Cosmos in which he highlights, unsung women in science. And I thought of Sarah Pocock and the fact that this was a woman in animation doing these animations about unsung women and how, you know, it was just kind of all tied together.
And then your head exploded with joy.
Into the cosmos.
Into the cosmos.
Yes, it's true. But Marge Dean, who's the co-president of Women in Animation, was recently talking about this issue in 2013. And the question was, you know, is there a gender gap in animation? Is there a lack of women at the top? And she basically said, yes, absolutely there is. And the reason she gave for it is, she says, I think it comes partly from cultural assumptions that have been passed down that think women are not creative, smart, or funny, or because women aren't encouraged to take the artistic lead. Or maybe it's because the folks in charge don't try to find women to fill creative roles. It's not a priority for them to rectify the imbalance. It's any and all of those things. So it sounds like we still have a lot of 1930s Disney mentality still afloat in the industry. But there's definitely progress being made. Despite hiccups like the 2011 incident with Brenda Chapman and the movie Brave.
Right. So we all know Brave with the amazing redheaded lead character, Merida. But yeah, Brenda Chapman was the first woman to serve as head of story on a Disney film, which was The Lion King. And she spent 8 years at DreamWorks Animation, where she was one of three directors on 1998's The Prince of Egypt before moving to Pixar. But when she was working on Brave, she ended up getting fired from directing it.
And which is kind of a bummer, considering that Brave was an idea that she had been working on for about 6 years, and it was inspired by her daughter. So it seemed like a very personal project. Maybe it was so personal that it got in the way of the work. Who knows? But her getting pushed off to the side definitely sparked a lot of conversation about the state of women in animation in big Hollywood. even though she still received a co-directing credit. Mm-hmm. So when they got the Oscar, she also got an Oscar. But it certainly, you know, it didn't make animation or Pixar particularly look any better, because Pixar had also gotten some flack for its underrepresentation of just strong female characters in general on screen, and also the roles of women behind the camera as well.
Yeah, well, speaking more about Pixar, the same thing happened to Jan Pinkava, who was directing Ratatouille, which came out in 2007, before Brad Bird came in and took it over and ended up winning an Oscar.
Yeah, I didn't know that about Ratatouille. And I love that film.
It is very cute.
A little bit of a bummer. But as, I mean, another reason why we are talking about women in animation right now is because Jennifer Lee, who directed Frozen, is getting so much press right now, because Frozen is now the first movie, animated or not, directed by a woman to earn $1 billion. So essentially, everybody's saying, hey, look, Jennifer Lee did it with Frozen, a film that is starring like two female protagonists, starring as though they're real women. But although I'm sure they are very real to a lot of girls who watch the film. But essentially, they're saying that, hey, okay, if Jennifer Lee can do this, then and make $1 billion with a B dollars off this movie, then the sky can be the limit. Surely, for women in animation. And she's also not the first woman to make her mark in terms of box office returns on an animated film.
That's right. Back in 2011, Jennifer Yu Nelson was in charge of Kung Fu Panda 2, which, after making $645 million worldwide, was, until Jennifer Lee came along, the highest grossing movie to be directed by a woman. And in an interview, Nelson was talking about how, like, yeah, I'm a woman in animation. I just puttered along doing my thing, and I didn't really pay any heed to the gender imbalance thing.
Yeah, and at the time, too, she also became the first woman to ever direct an animated feature for a major studio by herself. So unlike, for instance, Chapman co-directing Prince of Egypt, this was Jennifer Yu Nelson on her own. And she had worked on Kung Fu Panda 1, Part 1. And the head of DreamWorks, Jeffrey Katzenberg, actually handpicked her out of that crew to lead up Kung Fu Panda 2. Because apparently Katzenberg loves, quote, working with strong women. Like, he is all about having women at the top in DreamWorks Animation. It's sort of, he actually called out Disney in a quote to The Hollywood Reporter on a story about how 85% of DreamWorks Animation producers are women, and a lot of their C-level leadership also women. He said, historically, the animation industry was completely dominated by men. Disney, the nine old men, it was a male world. And until recently, the whole field of engineering, software, technology was also dominated by men. It's changing, and it's changing rapidly, especially at our place where almost every director of our films is a woman, and all the female directors directed at DreamWorks. Oh, and excuse me, that was him talking to the LA Times. Nonetheless, a pretty incredible quote to hear from someone at that level, basically calling out Disney and the nine old men and saying, hey, you know what? I'm doing it a little differently.
And then he drops the mic.
Yeah.
Or the inking pen.
But I wonder, though, whether the environment for women working at Disney is different than women working at DreamWorks, whether that trickles down to the day-to-day process.
Yeah,
at all.
Know.
I couldn't find, and maybe it's just because Disney, I'm sure, is very good with their communications and sort of their message, public messaging, mm-hmm, about what it's like to work inside the company. I didn't find any insider reports on how much the company had progressed from the days when women would have been relegated to the nunnery of ink and paint, whether they're a lot more gender blind than they used to be. I'm sure they are, at least somewhat. It has to be somewhat better.
Yeah. But you know, I know we should never read the comments, ever. But I was reading the comments under some of these stories about women in animation today, and there were a lot of people who were saying, like, what is so important about the push to get women animators up in front of young girls? Like, who cares? And I'm like, really? I feel like you know how to answer this question if you think about it. And it's going to take people like Jeffrey Katzenberg and like high-powered top-tier directors like Jennifer U. Nelson, getting up in front of people, being successful, being famous, and doing it to show girls that they can do it too. But also, more importantly or not than that, is showing people who are in the box office, who are in charge of raking in the dough from all of these films, that women can successfully make a high-grossing movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's money that matters.
Yeah, it's money that matters. And it just seems like Jeffrey Katzenberg is willing to put his money where his mouth is.
Yeah, and I mean, even going back, though, to those early days of Disney with Snow White, you mentioned earlier in the podcast the blush coloring on Snow White's rosy cheeks. That was the little brainchild of one of the women in Ink and Paint, I believe, who said, oh, she looks so pale. She needs a little bit of blush in her cheeks.
Sounds like my mother. You look so pale. You need blusher.
She needs a little bit of blusher. But that's why, in a way, too, diversity is a good thing, because you bring in different perspectives and hopefully offer a better rounded story for your audience.
That is a noble goal, as is a good flush on the cheeks.
Exactly. You need a good flush on the cheeks.
Because that's how people got hired at Disney back in the day. So
yeah. I mean, and if anything, I hope that we've done our part a little bit to shine some light on those women, so many of them, who helped bring those early Disney stories to life, because it's such a massive undertaking. And while, yeah, the Nine Old Men, what a cool crackerjack group of men, but there were, you know, 100 women behind them inking and filling in and tracing and painting and hoping that their Angora sweater fluff didn't get on any of the cells.
That's right.
Which that did, yeah, I mean, that happened.
Yeah.
So, now I'm sure there are some Disney buffs listening who have a lot of history to fill us in on, because this by no means was a history of Disney, nor was it intended to be. But if you have some pertinent Disney insights to give us, we want to hear from you. Also, women animators listening, I know there are some of you out there who are listening right now. Let us know what it's like for you. Is there still this, do you sense a gender gap at all in the profession? MomStuff@discovery.com is where you can email us. You can also tweet us at MomStuffPodcast or message us on Facebook. And we've got a couple of messages to share with you right now.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Tennessee just sounds perfect. Whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
So I've got a letter here from Amy about our military spouses episode. She writes, I'm a huge fan of the podcast, and as an Army wife of 3 years, your latest episode about military spouses was particularly interesting. You nailed it when discussing spouses being un or underemployed. When I got my teaching degree, I never thought that finding a job would be an issue because everybody needs teachers, right? But after moving to our latest post, it's been a struggle. I actually found a job that I love working for a university, but it's only part-time and offers no room for growth. So I'm still sending out resumes and going on interviews, hoping to find a job as a teacher, even though the job market is hyper-saturated here. Also, I wanted to add that I'm thankful you included information about reintegration, the time after deployment when soldiers return home. After my husband's first deployment, we really struggled. Everyone else sees the joyful tears of a homecoming and think it's happily ever after. For those in the marriage, that happy ever after takes a lot of work. We had vastly different life experiences, and learning to just be took time. Throw in two moves in less than a year, time apart for field training in schools, and the usual unpredictable challenges of life, and it was ugly. We finally got into a rhythm, and my husband was sent back to Afghanistan in February of this year. The upside is that when he comes home this time, I'll have a better idea of what to expect. Thanks so much for delicately handling a potentially loaded topic. This episode was chock full of good stuff and really respectful. So thanks, Amy, and good luck with your husband's deployment. Best wishes for his safe return home.
And I have a letter here from Anne who says, I was a military spouse down in Fort Stewart, Georgia for about 12 years. My husband got out of the military and we moved back to South Dakota. We have had to deal with numerous deployments overseas, three times to Iraq and twice to Afghanistan. Just about everything you spoke about rang true to me. I also had to deal with alienation from many of the spouses as well because I was one of the few who had no children. Most activities are centered around the children, so when you don't have any, you don't get invited to anything except for maybe once or twice a year. The rules were that everyone was supposed to be included in things, but this rarely happened. The healthcare benefits and financial aid in the military were extremely helpful many times. Especially for a newlywed couple just starting out on their own, it can provide stability, learning responsibility, and independence from family. For those things, I was grateful. Due to the constant danger of him being deployed, kept me from wanting to have children in case anything happened. I lost a parent at a young age and didn't wish for my child to go through that. Luckily, we got through everything and he is safe and we are expecting our first child, a daughter, in August. One of the things that got me through the last few deployments was the numerous podcasts at How Stuff Works. Thank you guys, all of you, so much for helping keep my mind busy and from stressing out too much. So thank you, Anne, and I'm glad you guys are doing well, and congratulations on your baby.
And thanks to everybody who's written in to us. MomStuffAtDiscovery.com is our email address. And to find links to all of our social medias, videos, podcasts, and blogs, there's one place to go, and it's StuffMomNeverToldYou.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise, all things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC. Tennessee just sounds perfect, whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.